All right, let's jump into this deep dive, specifically designed for you gastroenterologists out there facing the SCE exam. We know it's a beast, so we're focusing on those must-know facts about GI neuroendocrine tumors, the NETs, and GISTs, gastrointestinal stromal tumors. We'll be using the GINET GIST.pdf you provided.
We'll cut through the noise and get you that high-yield info you need and highlight those subtle details that'll make a real difference in your practice.
Sounds good. So GI neuroendocrine tumors, or NETs, one of the first things that jumps out is just how diverse these tumors behave. And it seems like their location in the GI tract really dictates that behavior.
Yeah, it's fascinating. They come from those neuroendocrine cells kind of sprinkled throughout the digestive system. And you're right, location plays a big role. Like gastric NETs, those arising in the stomach really show us this.
And gastric NETs, those seem to be a favorite on the SCE exam. And I can see why, with those distinct subtypes. Each one having its own little personality and management considerations.
Absolutely. Let's start with type 1 gastric NETs. Those are the most common, frequently linked to chronic atrophic gastritis and pernicious anemia, both of which, you know, lead to a decrease in stomach acid production.
So the stomach's normal acidic environment gets disrupted.
Yeah.
What impact does that have on how these tumors develop?
Great question. That low acid environment actually kicks off a chain reaction. First, you get a surge in serum gastrin levels. That, in turn, stimulates those neuroendocrine cells to multiply, hyperplasia we call it, and ultimately that leads to multiple, usually small polyps, the hallmark of type 1 gastric NETs.
And generally, those type 1 tumors tend to have a pretty good prognosis, right?
Generally, yes. We usually classify them as grade 1, stage 1, indicating their indolent nature. And often endoscopic resection for those under 2 centimeter, followed by endoscopic surveillance every 6 to 12 months is enough.
So early detection, early intervention, key. Now, where do type 2 gastric NETs fit in?
They're intricately linked to Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, or ZES, that condition with the gastrin-producing tumor, the gastrinoma.
Ah, yes, the infamous ZES. So that excessive gastrin secretion from ZES, that's what drives those type 2 gastric NETs, right?
Exactly. Now, they do have some malignant potential, but typically they're less aggressive than their type 3 counterparts. Like type 1, endoscopic resection can be an option for smaller tumors. Again, followed by close endoscopic surveillance.
Okay, so the more common types. Now, what about type 3 gastric NETs? They seem like the wild card of the group.
They are. They're sporadic, so they pop up without those elevated gastrin levels. And unlike types 1 and 2, they tend to be far more aggressive. Actually, up to 65% of cases can present with metastases already at diagnosis.
That's a pretty stark contrast to the more indolent behavior of the other types. How does that impact how we approach management?
Well, their aggressive nature means we need to be more assertive. Often that means more expensive surgery, like a partial or total gastrectomy, potentially with systemic therapy if it's spread.
So accurately pinpointing that specific type of gastric NET, that's critical for making the right diagnosis and treatment choices. It's not just some academic thing. This has real-world impact for our patients.
Absolutely. And to distinguish them, we need to be familiar with the tools we have. Endoscopy with biopsy is still the gold standard. Lets us see the tumor and get tissue for analysis.
Right.
We also have serum markers, chromogranin A, elevated in most NETs. And serum gastrin, particularly useful for differentiating those type 1 and type 2 gastric NETs.
And imaging. That plays a key role in staging, right?
Yeah.
Assessing the extent of the disease.
Essential. CT and MRI for staging. But G68-PDCT, that's the one that helps us pinpoint those somatostatin receptors. It gives us a clearer picture of how far it spread and might pick up metastases that conventional imaging misses.
So clinical presentation, endoscopy findings, serum markers, imaging, putting it all together helps us paint that complete picture of the gastric NET and tailor the management. Now, moving down the digestive tract a bit, let's talk about colorectal NETs. And location seems to be key here, too. A big difference between tumors in the colon versus those in the rectum.
Great point. Yeah. Colon and rectal NETs both fall under colorectal, but they can behave and be managed quite differently. Colon NETs, they're less common than rectal, but they tend to be more aggressive. Often they're caught later, sometimes with complications like bowel obstruction.
And then rectal NETs, probably thanks to all the colonoscopy screening we're doing, they're usually caught earlier.
Yeah.
Smaller, less likely to have spread.
Exactly. And that brings up a critical point about managing rectal NETs. Size really matters. Size really dictates the risk of metastasis and therefore how we treat them.
So how do we stratify the risk based on size when we're talking rectal NETs?
Okay, so for those smaller than 1 centimeter, that risk of metastasis is really low, less than 5%. But as the tumor grows, so does the risk. Between 1 and 2 centimeters, it jumps to about 10 to 15%. And anything larger than 2 centimeters, we're looking at a much higher risk, over 60%.
Wow. Those numbers really drive home the importance of knowing those cutoffs. How do we use this information to guide our management?
Well, smaller rectal nets, those under 1 centimeters, can often be handled with endoscopic techniques, like endoscopic mucosal resection or endoscopic submucosal dissection. But for larger tumors, or those showing signs of deeper invasion, surgical resection with lymph node dissection becomes the standard.
A balancing act. Weighing the risk of metastasis against the potential problems from surgery. Knowing these size cutoffs really helps us make those informed choices. Now let's move on to another interesting category. Pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. PANETs. What makes these stand out?
PANETs, they're relatively rare, incidence of about 1 case per 100,000 people per year. But they present unique challenges for diagnosis and management. One of the first things to understand is they can be functional or non-functional.
By functional, meaning they produce hormones, right. And depending on which hormone, that can lead to a whole bunch of symptoms.
Right. Functional PANETs, depending on what they're producing, can cause all sorts of issues. Insulinomas lead to hypoglycemia. Gastrinomas can cause those peptic ulcers and diarrhea. And VPOMAs, those can cause watery diarrhea and hypokalemia. And these hormone-related symptoms, they often dominate the picture, masking the tumor itself.
So recognizing those hormonal syndromes, crucial, because those might be the first clue. What about those non-functional PANETs? How do they typically present?
They're more common than the functional ones, often present with non-specific symptoms, abdominal pain, weight loss, that kind of thing. Sometimes they're even found incidentally on imaging studies done for something else entirely.
So the presentation can be anything from dramatic hormonal syndromes to subtle non-specific symptoms. How do we even approach diagnosing these?
Suspicion is key. If a patient has symptoms that make us think of a hormonal syndrome, or if we find a pancreatic mass on imaging, PANETs need to be on the differential. Confirming the diagnosis means combining imaging studies like CT scans or MRI with blood tests to check those hormone levels.
And once we know it's a PANET, what guides our management strategy?
It's complex. Needs a multidisciplinary approach. Surgery is often the cornerstone, trying to get it all out. But the decision to operate depends on factors like the tumor size, location, if it's functional, and whether it's spread.
So not a one-size-fits-all approach. We need to carefully consider all those factors to figure out the best way to go.
Exactly. For tumors larger than 2 centimeters, surgery is usually recommended. But smaller ones, under 2 centimeters, we might consider observation or surgery depending on whether it's functional, causing symptoms, and how fast it's growing. And of course, if it's already spread, the focus shifts to systemic therapies like chemo, targeted therapies, or peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, PRRT.
So a whole range of options. Watchful waiting to surgery to systemic therapies, each tailored to the tumor's specific characteristics and the individual patient. This brings us to our final category for this part of our deep dive, gastrointestinal stromal tumors, or GISTs. What makes these different from the NETs we've been talking about?
GISTs are fascinating because their origin is completely different. They come from the interstitial cells of Kajal, pacemaker cells found in the wall of the GI tract. These cells are responsible for regulating the rhythmic contractions of the GI muscles.
And unlike NETs, which we classify by location and histological grade, GISTs seem to be all about their molecular features, especially mutations in certain genes.
You got it. Most GISTs have mutations in those KIT or PDGFRA genes. These genes code for proteins involved in cell signaling and growth. And these mutations basically act like oncogenic drivers. They lead to uncontrolled cell proliferation, and that's how GISTs form.
So more than just a scientific curiosity, these mutations play a central role. And as we'll discuss later, they give us targets for therapy.
Exactly. But before we get to that exciting world of targeted therapies, let's talk about diagnosing GISTs. Pathology is crucial here. When we look at a GIST under a microscope, we often see a mix of cell types, spindle cells, epithelioid cells, or a combo of both.
And to confirm the diagnosis, we rely on immunohistochemistry, looking for expression of certain markers like CD117 and DOG1. Those are highly sensitive and specific for GISTs.
Absolutely. Immunohistochemistry is key for differentiating GISTs from other mesenchymal tumors that might look similar under the microscope. And in addition to CD117 and DOG1, we might also look for other markers, such as CD34, to refine the diagnosis further.
So morphology and immunohistochemistry, hand in hand, help us pinpoint a GIST. What about imaging? What's its role in evaluating these tumors?
Imaging is essential for figuring out the location, size, and extent of the GIST. CT scans are our workhorse. We can visualize the tumor and see if there is any local invasion or distant spread. EUS, or endoscopic ultrasound, that's super helpful for pinpointing exactly which layer of the GI wall the tumor's coming from. And PCT can be useful for staging and detecting metastases.
Okay, so we have a grasp on how to diagnose these GISTs. But prognosis, what determines how well a patient with a GIST will do?
Great question. The answer lies in a few key features of the tumor itself. Tumor size is one of the most important prognostic factors. Larger tumors, especially those over 5 centimeters, are associated with a worse outlook.
So size definitely matters when it comes to GIST. Anything else we look at when we're assessing prognosis?
Mitotic rate is another crucial factor. That's how quickly the tumor cells are dividing. A high mitotic rate, meaning rapid cell division, is a red flag. Often signals a more aggressive tumor, a poorer prognosis.
A large tumor with a high mitotic rate, that's not good.
It's not. And besides size and mitotic rate, we also consider the tumor's location. GIS in certain spots, like the small intestine, tend to have a worse prognosis compared to those in the stomach, for example.
So a complex interplay of factors. Knowing them helps us stratify risk and make informed treatment decisions.
Exactly. And as we'll discuss in the next part of our deep dive, understanding these prognostic factors is critical when we start talking about treatment options, especially the role of targeted therapies.
A great segue into the next part of our discussion. We've covered a lot of ground in this first segment, laying the foundation for understanding the key characteristics of GI NETs and GISTs. But before we move on to management, let's take a quick pause to solidify what we've learned. Ready for a little case-based review?
Absolutely. Putting this knowledge into practice is the best way to really make it stick. Bring on the cases. Welcome back to our deep dive into GI tumors. We've laid down a solid foundation, dissected those NETs and GISTs, their classification, how we diagnose them. Now let's talk management.
Yeah, building on that, I'm really interested in GIST management, especially with that unique molecular profile they have. We touched on targeted therapies last time. I'd love to dig into that more.
It's a really exciting area. Remember those KIT and PDGFRA mutations? Well, those have opened up a whole new avenue. Targeted therapy.
Can you expand on that? How do we use those mutations to our advantage?
Yeah.
You know, in the fight against GISTs?
Okay, so targeted therapies, like tyrosine kinase inhibitors or TKIs, they're designed to specifically block the activity of those mutated proteins, essentially cutting off the fuel supply to the tumor.
Like hitting the brakes on that uncontrolled growth.
Exactly.
Can you give us an example of a TKI commonly used for GISTs?
Imatinib is a great example. Revolutionized GIST treatment. It binds to those mutated KIT and PDGFRA proteins, stops them from sending those growth signals.
Imatinib has really become a cornerstone of treatment, but I imagine deciding when and how to use it can get tricky. What guides those decisions?
You're right. It's not one size fits all. We tailor imatinib based on a risk assessment of the individual tumor. We look at size, mitotic rate, location. High-risk tumors, the large ones, the ones with a rapid mitotic rate, or in certain locations, they're more likely to benefit from imatinib.
So really personalizing treatment based on the tumor's features. Can you give some examples of how imatinib is used in practice?
Sure. We can use it as adjuvant therapy, meaning giving it after surgery to reduce the risk of recurrence, especially important in those high-risk cases where that risk is high.
Like an extra layer of protection after you remove the tumor.
Exactly. We can also use it as neoadjuvant therapy. That means giving it before surgery.
Interesting. What's the thinking behind giving it beforehand?
The goal there is to shrink the tumor before we try to remove it surgically. This can be really helpful for those large tumors or tumors in tricky spots anatomically. Shrink it first, potentially make the surgery less extensive, and increase the chances of getting it all out with clear margins.
Kind of softening it up before the main attack.
Exactly. Now, it's important to remember that not all GISTs respond to imatinib the same way. Some might be resistant right off the bat, others might develop resistance over time.
Which brings up the question, what do we do when imatinib doesn't work? Or when resistance develops.
That's where understanding those molecular details comes in. Remember the different types of KT and PDGFRA mutations? Well, some are more likely to lead to imatinib resistance.
So it's not just about having the mutation, but knowing which type.
Exactly. Luckily, we now have second-line TKIs, sinitinib, regorafenib, for example. They can be effective in those cases where imatinib isn't working or stops working. They target the same pathways, but they bind differently, which makes them effective against those resistant mutations.
Like having a backup plan.
Exactly. And even with metastatic disease where it's spread, TKIs can still provide control. sometimes even shrinking tumors and improving survival. In some situations, we might even consider surgery to remove those isolated metastases, if possible.
Encouraging to know that even in those advanced cases, we have options that can make a difference.
Absolutely. Now, we've covered a lot about GIST management. It's important to see how this knowledge plays out in real life. So to solidify these concepts, let's put on our detective hats and walk through a few case scenarios.
Love a good case. Always the best test.
Great. Let's start with case 4. A 60-year-old patient, history of chronic gastroesophageal reflux disease, presents with anemia and persistent abdominal pain. Endoscopy shows a large ulcerated mass in the stomach. Biopsy shows spindle cells, and immunohistochemistry is positive for CD117. What's your top differential?
Okay, let's break it down. Yeah. History of GRD, anemia, abdominal pain, large ulcerated mass in the stomach. And those biopsy findings, spindle cells, CD117 positivity, that strongly points to a GIST, a gastrointestinal stromal tumor.
You got it. Now, given that size and ulceration, what would you do for staging and management?
With that presentation, this seems like a high-risk GIST. Definitely staging with imaging, like a CT or PT-CT, to check for any spread. And considering those high-risk features, neoadjuvant imatinib would be a strong contender. Try to shrink it before going in for surgery.
Excellent reasoning. You've definitely got those GIST management principles down. Let's switch gears a bit. Case 5. A 45-year-old patient, routine colonoscopy, finds a 1.5-centimeter rectal net. Biopsy confirms a well-differentiated net. What factors are you thinking about for this patient?
Right, 1.5-centimeter rectal net. Size is key here, and this falls into that intermediate risk zone, around 10 to 15% risk of metastasis.
Right. What else would you want to know to guide your decisions?
Well, besides size, I'd want to know how deep it goes. Has it gone beyond the mucosa? Are there any high-risk histological features, like a high mitotic rate? And of course, the patient's overall health, and any surgical risk factors.
All great points. For rectal nets this size, endoscopic submucosal dissection or transanal excision might be options if it's limited to the mucosa and doesn't have those high-risk features. But deeper invasion or concerning histology, surgical resection with lymph node dissection would be the safer bet.
A delicate balance, weighing the risks and benefits of each approach.
Absolutely. That's what makes gastroenterology, especially managing these complex tumors, so challenging and interesting. Ready for our last case?
Hit me with it.
Okay, here we go. A 50-year-old patient, recurrent episodes of peptic ulcers and diarrhea. Gastrin levels are through the roof. What's at the top of your differential?
Peptic ulcers, diarrhea, sky-high gastrin levels. That screams Zollinger-Ellison syndrome.
Spot on. Now, which type of gastric net is classic for ZES?
That would be type 2 gastric nets. Remember, driven by all that excess gastrin from the gastrinoma.
Perfect. How would you confirm ZES and find that gastrinoma?
Confirming the diagnosis would involve putting together the clinical findings, lab tests, and imaging. We've got the ulcers, diarrhea, and hypergastrinemia. To really nail it down, we could do a secretin stimulation test. That would typically show a big jump in gastrin levels in someone with ZES. And to find the gastrinoma, imaging studies like CT, MRI, or somatostatin receptor scintigraphy would be key. Sometimes those tumors can be tiny and tough to find, so we might need specialized imaging like endoscopic ultrasound or even intraoperative ultrasound.
You've laid out a really comprehensive diagnostic approach. Now say we've confirmed ZES and found the gastrinoma. How are we managing this patient?
ZES management is multi-pronged. First, got to tackle that hypergastrinemia and what it's doing. Usually means high-dose proton pump inhibitors to suppress acid production help those ulcers heal.
Right. Controlling that acid is critical. What about the gastrinoma itself?
Ideally, surgery. Get it out, especially if it's localized and the patient's a good candidate for surgery. But we have to carefully consider factors like where it is, how big it is, and whether it's spread.
What if surgery is not an option? Or if it's part of a bigger picture, like MENN, multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1?
Then we have other ways to control gastrin and manage symptoms. Somatostatin analogs, like octreotide or lanreotide, can effectively bring down those gastrin levels. We might also think about other meds, like histamine H2 receptor blockers, or even targeted therapies in some situations.
Sounds like a multidisciplinary approach is key for ZES. You've shown a solid grasp of these complex concepts. I think our listeners will find this discussion very helpful.
Absolutely. Case-based discussions like this are the best way to really understand it all. Now, I'm excited to dive into those advancements that are shaping the future of GI tumor management. Things like molecular diagnostics, targeted therapies, immunotherapy.
Perfect transition to the final part of our deep dive. We'll explore those cutting-edge advancements and how they're changing the game in gastroenterology.
Welcome back to this final part of our deep dive. We've gone through how to diagnose and manage GI NETs and GISTs, so now let's focus on what's coming next. The advancements changing how we handle GI tumors.
It really is an exciting time to be in this field. We're seeing a huge shift from those traditional broad therapies to a much more personalized and precise approach.
It's like we're entering a whole new world of precision medicine where we can really tailor those strategies to each tumor's individual quirks.
Exactly. And a big part of that is molecular diagnostics. It's evolving so rapidly. We talked about the importance of KIT and PDGFRA mutations in GI tests, but we're discovering so many more genetic alterations now, specific mutations, even gene expression patterns that play a role in how the tumor behaves.
So it's not just about finding a mutation. It's about understanding the whole genetic picture, like you're saying, deciphering the tumor's unique blueprint.
Exactly. And this deeper understanding lets us develop even more targeted therapies, drugs that zero in on those specific weaknesses within the tumor cells.
I can see how that kind of precision could completely change how we treat these. Can you give us some examples of these targeted therapies and how they're being used for GI tumors?
Sure. With GISTs, we're moving beyond just imatinib. We've got second-generation TKIs now, like sunitinib and regorafenib. They're effective against those imatinib-resistant tumors. And the research is ongoing. Even more potent and specific inhibitors are in development, targeting other pathways involved in GS development.
So it's constantly evolving, new targets and new drugs all the time. What about NETs? Are we seeing similar progress there?
Absolutely. We're finding specific biomarkers and molecular targets in NETs, too, to guide treatment. For instance, some PANET subtypes express somatostatin receptors, which means we can use somatostatin analogs. They're really effective at controlling hormone secretion and tumor growth. And for NETs that express the VEGF receptor, we've got targeted therapies like sunitinib, which can block angiogenesis and slow down that tumor progression.
It seems like we're headed toward a future where we can choose the most effective therapy based on the tumor's molecular profile, almost like a personalized medicine approach.
You got it. And as we keep unraveling those molecular mysteries, we're not only creating more targeted drugs, but also figuring out how to predict which patients will respond best to which treatments. That's precision medicine in a nutshell, getting the right treatment to the right patient at the right time.
This is all very exciting, but also sounds incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
How do we actually use all this molecular data to make decisions in the clinic?
That's where specialized testing and a multidisciplinary approach are so important. We have advanced genomic profiling platforms now that can analyze the tumor's DNA and RNA. It's like getting a detailed blueprint.
So we send a tumor sample to the lab, and they can tell us what's making it grow and the best way to target it.
That's the idea. And with that molecular knowledge, we can bring together a team of experts: oncologists, surgeons, pathologists, geneticists, and more. We discuss the best plan for each patient. It's a team effort, using everyone's expertise.
A far cry from just relying on tumor type and stage to make treatment decisions, we're really entering a new era of personalized oncology.
We are, and this level of precision isn't just improving how we treat, it's also minimizing side effects. That means better quality of life for our patients.
It's amazing how far we've come in such a short time. But it doesn't stop with targeted therapies, right? We've also got all this progress in immunotherapy. That's a whole other level, using the immune system to fight cancer.
The immunotherapy really is changing the game. It's already a big deal in treating other cancers, and we're starting to see its potential in GI tumors, too. Basically, we're trying to wake up the immune system, teach it to recognize and attack those tumor cells that might have been missing before.
So instead of attacking the tumor directly with drugs, we're helping the body fight back on its own.
Right. And there are different ways to do that. We've got checkpoint inhibitors, those drugs that take the brakes off the immune system so it can really go after those tumor cells. And then there's TCAR T-cell therapy, a really advanced approach where we actually modify the patient's own immune cells. It's like turning them into super soldiers to hunt down and destroy cancer cells.
Those are some incredible advancements. Where do we stand with immunotherapy for GI tumors right now?
It's still relatively early days for GI tumors, but the initial results are promising. We're seeing some good responses in patients with advanced NETs and GISTs, so there's hope this could become standard treatment in the future.
It's inspiring to see how these breakthroughs are giving new hope to patients.
It really is. And as these advancements keep happening, the SCE exam will have to keep up. So to all our listeners out there preparing for the exam, keep your eyes open, embrace the future of gastroenterology, and never stop learning.
Great way to wrap up our deep dive into the world of GI tumors. We've covered a lot. Classification, diagnosis, management, those latest advancements in molecular diagnostics, targeted therapies, and immunotherapy. And we got a glimpse into the future of this field. We hope this deep dive gave you some valuable knowledge, but also that it inspired you to keep striving for excellence in gastroenterology. Remember, lifelong learning is key to being an exceptional clinician. Until next time, stay curious, keep those minds sharp, and best of luck on your SCE exam.